Hello and welcome to episode 71 of Entertainment of Excellence, the podcast where we talk about films, TV, all of it. Hi, I'm Ollie.
I'm Tom.
And I'm Ben.
And today we're talking about the 1931 film M.
First half of this will be completely spoiler free, and then we'll be doing a deep dive with spoilers at about the 20 minute mark.
Timestamps below. Right, M. Does the M stand for movie?
No, the M stands for
Murder, I think is what it stands for. Murder, yummy, is the full title, but they weren't allowed to put that on posters. So the brief, of course, spoiler-free plot summary is that a murderer is terrorizing a small town of 4 million people. It's not that small. It's quite a big town. And the police are desperately trying to look for them. But because of the intense raids the police are doing, it's disrupting the criminal underworld of the town. And so, in fact, the criminals also band together to try and hunt down the murderer. And then things happen. But of course, we can save those twists and turns for the spoiler section in case people don't want to be spoiled for this film from over 90 years ago.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Well, okay, let's just get one thing out of the way first. Am I the only one that thought that the villain looks like Percy from Thomas the Tank Engine?
There is one big problem going for you there, in that he's not a train.
Yeah, but he's got a very round face and big eyes.
It's kind of true.
That's why specifically Percy and not just any of the engines?
Well, it's not Thomas and it's not Gordon. It's definitely not the helicopter, whatever he's called.
That's true.
Well, I can't remember the name of the train that got bricked up in that tunnel, but
that'd be the same actor.
Maybe, that episode is a study in whether punishment is justified. So
exactly.
You know what, Ben?
I've got
a picture of Percy up. It could be. I see the resemblance. Anyone done a dig into Percy's mental health background?
I don't know. I feel like we should let the Fat Controller know.
We should, really.
Indeed.
Well, it's interesting that we talk about Percy getting stuck in a tunnel, which maybe you could describe a tunnel as possibly a hall in a mountain, which brings me on to...
Oh, now that's a segue if ever I've heard one.
Yes, which brings me on to one of the great things that this movie kind of invents for a trope of serial killer movies. This is about 40 years before the term serial killer was invented, which is crazy. Insane.
That's insane.
So basically, the murderer, he goes around and he whistles in the Hall of the Mountain King, and it starts to become this kind of signifier that he's nearby, even if you can't see him on screen. So as soon as you hear, like, you go, which is very, very good use of a leitmotif, which, according to a very reliable source called Wikipedia, is I'm gonna say one of just to set myself safe here. One of the first instances of a leitmotif being used outside of opera. So there you go. Fritz Lang stole from opera.
Yeah.
Another bit of trivia is that the actor apparently could not whistle. So the whistling is actually done by Fritz Lang himself.
Yeah. I saw that. Yeah. It's quite interesting. I mean, one of the biggest things about this is it's obviously one of the first, not the first movie with sound, but one of the sort of pioneering films that actually used sound. And the interesting thing about that is this movie doesn't have any sort of soundtrack apart from the In the Horn, the Mountain King leitmotif, which is an interesting choice, I think, because it's like the movies around the time would have all had soundtracks by necessity, you know, like the silent films having like piano soundtracks to accompany them.
And so it's around the time that... What were we saying?
Yeah, so it's not like it was before soundtracks became a thing. It was obviously quite a sort of artistic choice to leave out a soundtrack.
And one thing that I saw somewhere is that as films transitioned towards talkies, a lot of them sort of utilised the fact that there was now sound almost excessively, whereas this does it very, very intentionally. And I think it's interesting comparing it to Fritz Lang's earlier work. I mean, the only other thing I've seen by him is Metropolis.
But
like that obviously is reliant on sound throughout. And then to have something like this that's so stripped back with in terms of a soundtrack, and it really leaves you with these quite extended scenes of silence. But then using that leitmotif, as you were saying, so deliberately, it's so interesting to think that like he was able to put across this really deliberate use of sound in a way that I've seen very few films do since. Like to say this is such a early pioneering film that set up these tropes, but do it still remains in a way of doing it so interesting compared to stuff that came later. You almost forget that it came out when it did. When you sort of go back and check 1931, it's just sort of mind-blowing to even imagine that, both in terms of the use of sound and then also, as you're saying, the style. Because I think Hitchcock had done one sort of serial killer-esque film before, but this was like one of the very early ones that...
It was very sort of proto-like film noir with a lot of the...
Yeah.
With a lot of the tropes that would then become used in sort of like the American detective type stories of like the 30s and 40s. But it's like pioneered here in Germany a good sort of, you know, 10 years before the style was very popularized. I think that's quite interesting because you've got stuff like the police procedural, I think is the actual term for it. You've got the police trying to sort of solve a crime. You've got unreliable witnesses. You've got a serial killer that isn't present really for the first half of the movie. There's only a few sort of scenes he's in. And then there's sort of, you know, there's the closing in and but it then it's even more interesting because it kind of it divides itself from that style about the halfway point because it also sort of has the parallels with the mob. I'm trying to avoid any spoilers here, but there's sort of like two sort of interplaying groups of people, the police and the mob, like looking for the serial killer, and it's kind of trying to show like two different sorts of people and their different intentions, but maybe they're not so different after all.
Whoa. And it does a very good job, I think, of kind of, because there's quite a lot of characters, what it does is it makes the town the other character. As a kind of ensemble, so you get this great sense of kind of mob violence, as in just a big group of people thinking the same rather than the literal gangsters. Yeah. Like very early on, they just start randomly accusing people in the street who's, I don't know, giving directions to a child and things like that. And then they go, "Ah, it's the kinder murder, the kinder murder." And then they go, "No, I wouldn't do that." And they go, "Oh, you would." So you get, it turns out that the woke mob existed in 1931 as well, in Germany of all places. So maybe, as they say, history repeats itself. Yeah. So it shows you that cancel culture was also a problem back then. It's this kind of inherent like public desire for retributive violence. You still see it now of people, you know, that have clearly done terrible things. For example, murdering children. I think we could all agree is bad. But it's this thing of kind of strange, like mania takes hold of a lot of the citizens, just accusing anyone and attempting to. They're instantly. There's one where there's a pickpocket being taken off the bus, and then he just like casually brings up. No, he says like, "You shouldn't be after pickpockets. You should be after the child murderer." And then someone in the crowd goes like, "Did he say child murderer? He must kill kids." And then they're like, "Kill him! Kill him! Kill him! Kill him!" And it's like,
I think it's especially interesting that idea of sort of mass paranoia and the idea of scapegoats that in this film is very much justified to an extent because they are after a child murderer. But putting it in the context of Germany around that time and then what was to come after, I mean, this is like 2 years before Hitler came to power. And ultimately, a lot of the Nazi regime was built around similar ideologies of scapegoating groups. I think that very much reflects like a general sort of public unrest that was going on as the Nazis started to gain more and more power. And I think it's quite not necessarily that it's like a direct one-for-one comparison to those attitudes, but I think it is quite interesting seeing like how town responds in this sense when they have some sort of rationale behind it because they know that there's a child murderer, and how then, if you compare that to like under Hitler, how there's never really any justification in a real sense, but the way that the Nazis sort of betrayed that justification, that everyone latched onto it, and then there was like another form of scapegoat, you know, through the Jews and the other minorities that they latched onto, where that was very much conceived of in an abstract sense, whereas this is like in an actual sense where there is a reason to be paranoid, but still the way that they react might be seen as semi-irrational, especially towards the end. And that was quite interesting, like looking at Fritz Lang himself, because I think this might have been the last film he made in Germany. I think a couple of years later, he tried to make another thing that was banned. And then he himself basically fled to America. And then I think for like 20 years after that, he produced films in English. So it's one of those where it's interesting looking at it from the historical perspective of like the general feelings within Germany on the eve of the Nazi takeover, and how that sort of reflects in certain senses in the themes of the film.
Yeah, it's not so much a sort of one-to-one comparison for it, but it really does reflect the sort of attitudes that at the time where there was scapegoating and sort of mass paranoia that was directed against certain people and certain groups by those in power.
And one of the other interesting historical things is the real lack of fun things for children to do, because the film opens with what has to be one of the most boring playground games of all time, where someone stands in the middle of a circle and does this little nursery rhyme that's like, "The big scary man in the black coat, he's got a big chopper and he's going to chop you up." And then whoever it lands on they're out. You just do that over and over again. And I mean, there's no game there. There's no way. It's not skill based at all. It's entirely luck. There's no interaction. You just wait there while this person in the middle says this revolting song, waiting for your turn to get chopped up by this scary man. And there's no real game there. And one of the other characters, she is the presumably killed. You never really see what happens to them. Whose idea of fun is bouncing a ball off of a wanted poster for a murderer for a bit, which is a great shot, but it must have been boring living in 1931.
I mean, speaking of...
None of this would have happened to iPad kids. They'd be too entertained.
The iPad kids would be on it. You know, they'd all be inside watching their cocoa melons and skibbity toilets. These darn kids. I don't understand them. I'm too old to understand. I don't understand the internet.
No, neither do I.
Skibbity Toilet's got some pretty intricate lore behind it, to be fair.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Yeah,
fair enough.
We should do that as a podcast episode.
That's going to have to be like a special.
Meme 2023.
Extremely brief aside, this is purely because Skibbity Toilet is made in SFM, right? Source Filmmaker. And it seems that there is an SFM movie called Emesis Blue, which is heavily inspired by Ebb. So I saw in the comments of because Ebb is available on YouTube for free, seemingly all above board. And a lot of the comments are like, who's here after Emesis Blue? Or I watched this after Emesis Blue because I heard it was based on it. And it's I didn't realize it'd be so good. Emesis Blue is awesome. So I just thought that was odd.
So just before we get onto the spoiler section, let's talk a bit about sort of the cinematography and direction
Pete. As you were saying, the shot with the ball bouncing on the thing, and then
the silhouette,
the shadow which goes over the word murderer. Oh,
Fritz!
What a shot.
Fritzy boy, calm down. I was jumping out of my seat cheering. You know?
Don't blame
me. When Iron Man got... When Captain America picked up the hammer, I was sat motionless.
You were yawning, weren't you?
Nothing. I was yawning, in fact. But when that shadow...
I booed.
You booed. I remember. But when that shadow went across... the word murderer while the ball was bouncing, I stood up, I screamed, yes! And I applauded by myself. I was like, yes, Fritz, yes! Yes!
Your,
I got noise
complaints.
Neighbours
thought something else was going on in the room, but...
They did!
It was just you and Fritz in this intimate moment together.
Exactly. My neighbours thought that I was bouncing a ball against a wall and having a whale of a time, but actually, it was that shot was just so good. And I know that I've gone on about it so long that it sounds like I'm being ironic, but it's actually really, really cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool.
Yeah. The use of light and shadow is just... Oh, really good. Peak film.
And there's that shot as well where you see him looking in the mirror and in the window, and it's got a reflection and he can see a potential victim behind him.
Yes.
That shot is so powerful because, like, just in terms of shot composition, it's really cool. But then you also see he's got this like thing where he sort of plays with his face that you see earlier. Almost like Joker-esque.
I was about to say, I was like, Joker just stole this because he's looking in the mirror and he makes himself frown with his fingers. I'm like, come on.
And I mean, we'll get onto this later, but you really see that like inner conflict with him. And I think in that scene, it's him. Because in the earlier scene, it's just him by himself in the mirror. But this is like, he can see someone and he's like trying to fight the urgency. And then he follows her and then, this isn't really to do with the cinematography, but she walks past this, I think it's like a bookshop, and they've got like an arrow going up and down, and then a hip, the Yeah, that was pretty cool.
That was really cool because you're like, oh, trans mode. Activated.
There was the direction as well. I was talking about this sort of.
I think it was down for the arrow.
Yeah,
the direction.
Oh, it's a joke. Ah, yeah.
Sorry.
No, but this like this intercut sequence where like the mob of angry people are trying to sort of make a plan as to how they're going to catch this guy, and the police are doing the same thing, and they sort of intercut this.
They finish each other's
sandwiches.
Yes, yeah. That's what I was going to say.
Yo.
That bit I was like, oh, awesome. That's also a very modern technique. It does so many things that you're like, whoa.
Very ahead of its time. And the two groups of people also reach like a breakthrough in their cases like at the same time as well.
Yeah. Awesome.
Very cool.
Is there
anything else spoiler
free? There's one thing
I want
to say, but I feel like I'll save it for. Is it like slightly spoilery? I guess.
Is it a bit spoilery?
Cool. A little bit. Well, if you haven't watched the film, this is your point. This is your reminder to stop watching us, watch the film, and then come straight back here.
You have to come back.
Because we've got so much more to say.
You know, we might end up. Well, I don't want to say it.
Spoiling it.
Yeah.
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 That's the biggest sin.
That's the worst thing. If I saw that there was a spoilerer, I'm going to say, if I found out there was one who's spoiled, yeah, I'd be after everyone in the street.
Oh yeah.
Punching them, asking for their birth certificate.
But what if it's in their nature and they don't want to spoil, but they feel compulsively that they have to?
Are we in the spoiler section then?
Apparently so.
Well. Spoilers.
Give us the spoilers, Tom. Dish them out.
The spoilers. So, the mob managed to use... Oh, so there's some great stuff. At the start, the murderer buys a balloon from a blind man when he's with the victim, and he whistles Hall of the Mountain King. And then later on, he's whistling it when the mob have enlisted basically all the beggars as their eyes. So John Wick stole that. And then the blind man hears the whistling and tells someone, "That's the guy! It's him! He's doing the whistling like from the time that the girl died." So then this guy, he hides in the bushes, does a chalk M on his hand. The famous M hand. And then gives him a cheeky pat on the back to mark him. And they chase him down to this big office building where he hides in the loft. And then the mob essentially just absolutely tear through the place, breaking all the ceilings and doors and things. And eventually catch him just before the police arrive. And then they have a little trial in the basement where the murderer, who's called like something Hans Beckert, he has a breakdown and he says that killing is in his nature. He doesn't remember doing it. He just gets an impulse to do it. And we'll probably talk about that scene quite a lot. But then they try and go, we're going to kill you anyway. But then the police arrive and capture him. And then we don't know what happens, actually. He just goes to court. And then at the end, there's three mothers who say, this won't bring him back. But we all need to look after our children or something. They said something like that. And apparently, I'll bring this up now. Apparently, this is quite a difficult cut to find, but in the original cut, after it fades to black, when they've said, like, we all need to look after our children. And then it fades to black. And then you hear them say, all of you.
Ooh.
A cheeky
nice
fourth wall break, but we don't get that. That's sad.
Well, let's talk about it a little bit, because I think it's a really interesting sort of plot that it does, because it throughout the film, right, I don't want to say it presents Beckett as sort of like sympathetic, like as a good guy, but you start to feel sort of a little bit of sympathy towards him as he's sort of being hounded by this just mob of angry people. And then that kind of flips back, because you're then reminded, well, he is a child murderer.
Mm.
And then he has this emotional speech in the basement where you suddenly have to come to terms with, oh, well, it might actually not be in his nature. So, you know, is it fair that we just kill him? If he's mentally ill, is he actually guilty for his actions? And then the police arrive and you're left with, like, no verdict. The film doesn't, like, answer that question for you.
Which is great stuff.
Yeah, it's... There's not many sort of films, especially now, that I feel would kind of take that sort of bold approach of... Not outright defending the villain, but, like, sort of... presenting him fairly, I'd say.
Yeah, another thing as well is that sort of moral ambiguity that you get through the ending, and as you say earlier, with maybe not necessarily sympathy, but the fact that, you know, it's sort of this uncontrollable urge he's got. But another thing I think that was quite interesting, well, first of all, you presented with who he is quite early on, even though in the first sort of 45 minutes or so he's not in it very much. You still know who he is, and you can tell who he is through the whistling. So it uses that as a way of you not necessarily having to see his face, which is also like a really clever way of setting up the way that the blind man works out who it is. But I think another thing that's quite interesting was how earlier in the film, it makes it look like he's a bit more sort of calculated than he actually is, and everything's all sort of mapped out, because you get that scene where he's writing a letter to the police and you hear the whistle, and it very much reminded me of sort of more recent films like Zodiac or Seven or something, where everything is this part of this big plan of the serial killer, and it's almost seen as like this, you know, insane and deranged motive, but kind of this big game to them. But so I think earlier, it seems like he's in a bit more control than he actually is, and he seems like more relaxed when you present it to him. But then as it goes on, you start to see that that's not the case at all. Like, he is just fighting these animalistic urges, and, he's not in control at all. So I think that was quite interesting, like, looking at how that compares to more modern stuff, where I feel like there's this tendency to present, even in, like, true crime type of stuff, I feel like sometimes they romanticize the genius of some of these killers and like evading the law and having this like big plan set up, whereas in this it was very much just like he couldn't control what he was doing. And when he admits at the end, like, when he got this urge to kill, it was like it brought out someone else. And then after, when he was trying to come to terms with that, it was like he couldn't even really associate with the fact that he'd done it.
But equally, I'd say that, though, you know, the scene where you see the reflection of the victim in the window and you've kind of got him watching. I saw that. I don't think that the expression on his face was more sort of like fear than anything else.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. It's like he's not in control of his actions, and it is just something that's sort of happening, like a compulsion that he can't control. And like that sort of scene kind of showed like he's kind of aware of what he's doing, but kind of like not enough to actually control himself.
Yeah, I think that was a big turning point. That, because did you feel the same at the sort of first act, where it seemed like he was a bit more calculated.
Yeah, it felt like he'd be this sort of cold, calculating, like, killer who's meticulously planning out which children to abduct, and then it kind of pivots and it just shows you that it's this little guy.
Yeah, and I really liked the contrast in the trial with bringing up the kind of mob leader. The defense attorney, quotation marks, says, it's like, well, aren't you wanted for 3 murders? And it's kind of, it's the contrast of those 3 murders where he understands what he's doing and still does them. So there's that kind of thing, but is probably less likely to murder in future. So it's then contrasting. It's this thing of wanting punishment, but is it right to punish someone who physically cannot control their actions? But obviously you can't also let them participate in society because they have an impulsion to murder children.
Yeah.
So it's this thing of, it's this really interesting question where it's like, well, they probably do belong in a mental institute ideally, but there is the thing of an increased likelihood of escape, or maybe he could be dismissed again on a mistake, which, of course, he had been in a mental institute before and been dismissed as safe and harmless. So you could understand that, well, there's the fear that could happen again. So is this really Yuan's take? Because I assumed when it started doing that it was going to go fully, well, you can't just punish someone for mental health issues that if they are truly impulsive that they've got no control over. But it still does have that thing of something needs to happen, but you don't know what. And it's very aware that it's not an ideal world. Like, it shows, it even does this throughout with smaller things, like with police investigations. It shows the fact of how a lot of, especially in 1931, they were basically solely relying on like witness testimonies, and maybe if they could find for a murder, let's just hope,
like,
that we find a knife with blood on it.
Potentially.
Yeah, there's fingerprints, or, you know, or it would be very obvious evidence because they didn't have DNA back then.
Was one of the first things that happened when they were looking for the person, is they had, like, something with fingerprints on. I can't remember what it was, but it was just like, yeah, we can't use this because so many people have touched it.
Yeah, and this thing of it being a scary new thing because it's too difficult to find him, because all of the, what do they say, he finds the victims by luck. It's a kind of chance encounter, so there's no way to connect them. So it shows all of these interesting problems with the police, and then they also just massively want, and showing the police massively just want to increase their powers, where one of them's like, more raids! We want to raid everything! We want to stop everyone in the street! I want to get in the houses and... Ah!
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how...
There's one officer in particular that seems to, like, really just enjoy, like, the power trip he's on.
Yeah, and it's interesting how they show those flaws with the police whilst having all these parallels with the criminals who, you know, are motivated by this sort of selfish desire, because they're like, oh, we can't really carry on doing our crimes as well when this guy's on the loose. But they are having the parallels with their conversations and methods. But the criminals are actually better at it because they sort of have insider knowledge, and they are the ones that ultimately kind of find him out. And then that's why towards the end you have this very interesting view on justice. And I think, although at first, like, when I was watching it, I thought the actual ending felt quite abrupt, but thinking back at it, I think it's very effective having it so open-ended and leaving it up to the audience to decide, like, what should happen to him. Because I think this is very ahead of its time in its ways of looking at kind of mental health, and that having that one guy who's presented this, like, like this drunk guy who is just talking nonsense, basically. But, you know, that is very much a debate in society now about treatment of mental health victims. And I think that, like, in that discussion, it's very sort of prophetic.
Yeah, I think it is quite a fair portrayal, because it's like the fact it was open-ended does leave you with the question of, what do you think? I mean, the last note of the film is that we should protect our kids, which is kind of the thing that everyone agrees on in that courtroom. But it's like people coming from it from different perspectives. Like the defense attorney, he's quite like fairly like following the letter of the law. And he's like, well, can this person be found guilty for his actions that he cannot control? Yes, I agree that he should be locked up and kept away from kids. And like, no one is pleading that he's innocent. He doesn't plead he's innocent, but you know, is it right to just kill him and just, you know, extinguish his life for the crimes that he's done, and versus like actually just locking him up away from the rest of society where he can't harm people? And then the other side is like, well, yeah, but he's already escaped once, you know, he might get out again. He has like killed kids, and there's this, I think, I don't know if it was the translation or not, but I feel like there was some hints to like he might have like sexually abused kids as well.
Yeah, there was.
Because it was like, you know, the condition we found them in, which is like, oh God.
Yeah.
So
which, like, I think was also, you could really elaborate back then, yeah, in movies. It'd be filth.
But so. the interesting thing, I don't know if you saw anything about this, but that final scene with the monologue from Beckett, where he's just like so desperate and sweaty and like screaming. Apparently, so Fritz Lang was quite notorious for his bad treatment of actors, and apparently he'd done that scene like 10 times in a row, with like the actor being kicked down the stairs and sort of beaten up. So it's like that's kind of got some moral issues in itself, because it's like, well, it got such a perfect, compelling performance that is just like, you know, so ahead of its time and just like fantastic in this sort of desperation it portrays. But was Fritz Lang himself right in doing that? Because, you know,
yeah,
that's,
I saw when he went to America, like, his methods are quite controversial, right? And I think he was like, some films were shut down or there's some complaints about something because he used similar techniques to that. But I mean, it really does bring out such a good performance of that guy. I mean, as you say, maybe that like fear and stuff is sort of semi-genuine, but I mean, I'm not saying it was right for him to like push him down the stairs 10 times, but it brought out a good performance, you know.
It brings out a timeless result that you can criticize the sort of conditions that it came about with, but you know, you can't argue with that. That's just a really compelling scene. So
I mean, another thing to say about Fritz Lang is, like, having watched Metropolis, which I can't remember exactly when that came out, but it was before this.
I think it was 1929.
I thought it was 27.
Well, either way,
well, like, let's go
watching
28.
That. Yeah,
like the average.
It's like it was such a pioneer for so many sci-fi tropes, and then taking this, which is the same for sort of noir films, like the fact that in such a close succession he was able to invent so many things in these two completely different genres, basically. But I think another thing is like the scale of the two, because Metropolis is such like a massive film. It's even it's sort of, you can't even really comprehend how it was made at that time. And apparently it took about a year to make. It lost a bunch of money. So in response to that, when he made M,
Six
I think
weeks,
it was made
it?
In like, yeah, like a really short amount of time. And you know, it's not a very long film. And I think it kind of benefits from that brevity, because you only really see one actual victim and then one potential victim later, when the guy puts the M on the back and he's sort of stopped. You get a sense that he's been doing this for a long time, and as it gets towards the end, you hear that about him being locked up before. But I think it makes it more personal in the sense that you see fewer victims, because if you saw just like a huge amount of, you know, it just like repeated him killing various people at the start, it would almost lose a sense of like this connection with him. It's kind of like that whole thing about statistics in war, like it kind of loses a sense, an essence of the personality
of it. The humanity.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting. The villain in Metropolis, again, is quite sort of dramatic and over the top and very sort of textbook evil, and polar opposite here, just someone who's kind of like you could argue he's a victim of his circumstance and his mental illness and that sort of thing, and just, you know, not like, I don't know, Hannibal Lecter or someone calculated. So yeah,
which is like interesting, because I'd have thought, just thinking about the period this came out, when you have sort of silent films, you need these really melodramatic, over-the-top performances to carry a lot of it. And you tend to get that a lot when you watch older films, where you have these almost caricatures and these very like obvious genre tropes. But to have those develop later with these like iconic characters like Hannibal Lecter, as you say, but that's originated in this, where it's a bit more stripped down and low key. I think that's really interesting to see how it's sort of evolved since then, and how, because I feel like oftentimes when you're looking at a specific genre and you go back to its origin, it's a bit like over the top and not as nuanced as more modern stuff. But the fact that this still sort of holds up,
yeah.
I mean, even like Citizen
sort of
Kane,
what it's going for,
yeah.
Cool. Anything else we should have a chat about before we rate?
Most of the stuff I
we've covered the M bit, so I think. Oh, one thing I wanted to mention is that I really liked the montage of the kind of lingering on the shots of all of the destroyed doors and walls and ceiling after they've gone through the office building. Because, I don't know, it just was cool to just kind of linger on the destruction they'd left behind. Whereas I feel like there's especially a lot of films just kind of show people doing these crazy rampages through. But the just slight moment that you take to linger on what they've left was, I don't know, it felt impactful. I don't know what it was supposed to do, but it made me feel something.
Also, another
usually good
notable shot was the, I think it's when you're first introduced to the beggars. It's like a 5 minute plus tracking shot that you don't even really realize hasn't cut. But
I didn't notice that. There you go.
Notice that until like I read up a little bit about it afterwards, and it was talking about this massive tracking shot, and then I was like, oh yeah, that was just one shot.
Yeah.
Whoa. Sort of,
yeah, really groundbreaking film.
Yeah.
Really weird to think it was released in the 30s.
Mm. And I love the shot of the police entering, because you don't really see them enter. You just see everyone, this big crowd.
Yeah,
is right
everyone
at the
just...
end. The big crowd stop, and then put all of their hands up. I was like,
And it's just silent.
It's so good. Good stuff.
Well,
also, $1.65 for two brandies. If you're wondering, that sounds cheap. I don't know what currency it was or how much that would be now.
I think it'd be five.
You think it'd be five? That's cheap for two brandies.
Yeah.
You know? What was the currency? The Reichsmark. 1.65, 1931 Reichsmark.
Yeah, this was a bit after hyperinflation, so the prices were quite good, I think.
That's good. In pounds.
In modern actual money.
Oh, it's difficult to do.
See, I've off topic. I've never understood how you're meant to like trans like get old currencies into like a new different currency. Do you like do you convert it into like pounds at the time and then that like work out the value in today's money, or do you like work out the value in that currency today and then convert that into pounds?
That's a good question.
There's this thing called the PPP, the purchasing price parity, which is meant to account for like the value of the currency at the time, but also the cost of living. So I think the first one you said is basically what that does.
So you kind of work out what the equivalent buying power in your currency it would be at the time, and then work out what that is today.
Yeah, but it's quite difficult because
it's not going to be an exact science. But
yeah, without going too much into it, you've got loads of different measures of first of all, like inflation, and then also what's actually included in the cost of living index, and then also obviously you have to account for changes in the currency values and also changes in the currency, because like at that state in Germany, they just changed the currency. So it was quite all over the place.
I can do it from 1938. Reichsmarks, maybe?
Yeah.
Should we work out what it is in Entertainment of Excellence ratings in 2024?
Ooh. Oh, we could. Yeah.
Okay. Tell you what, I'll go first. I think I really liked the movie. I think it was really groundbreaking, really thought-provoking. One of those where you actually leave and keep thinking about the movie rather than just having it being self-contained and you kind of don't think about it afterwards. I think that's always a really good point. I did feel like it dragged a little bit during sort of the middle, just before sort of the chase after Beckett. That could well be my attention span being terrible in 2024, but I think that and the lack of soundtrack being an artistic choice I respect, but I think it did leave some points kind of feeling rather odd. It might be better for me on a rewatch, but it felt like there was a lot of sort of empty space. Like there's shots where there's like virtually no background noise, where it is just silent, which is kind of a bit jarring. So I know it's like a little bit unfair to criticize that for sort of experimenting with like new technology at the time. It'd be like criticizing the Beatles for like panning the drums all the way to the left, but you know, I think that did still impact my enjoyment a little bit. So I'm gonna go.
How dare you have an opinion?
I'm gonna get roasted in the comments. We're gonna get one comment, like our first comment in like 4 months, and it's gonna be roasting me.
So comment down below to prove Ben wrong.
Yeah, come on, give us some engagement. Dislike the video.
If you got this far in the episode, comment M is for mid.
It was pretty mid.
Yeah, there we go.
I think I'm gonna go 7.8. So I'm not saying it's terrible, but you know,
I think 7.8 is far from terrible. If you ask me, I think that's very good. Well done, Fritz Lang. We'll get that score over to you by tomorrow so that he can enjoy that certificate. He's still around, right? Do we have his address?
Well, we could probably find out where his grave is. So mail it there.
His what?
His grave.
He's saying he's dead.
Is he dead?
No, that's just where he's living at the moment, under the ground.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, I didn't think that he was ill.
No, he's just like vibing in his little wooden box.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm going to say, which I think it, I also believe that in the middle there was a little bit of drag, but the ending was so good and I really liked the start and there were some great shots. And I actually thought that the silence helped add some tension, which was contrasted by the loud noises that came after, Ben. So, you know.
M is for Tom has a bad take.
M is for that. Yep. Yeah. So I'm
Tom
gonna,
has a bad take.
Right. I'm going to give it 8.000000M out of 10.
Ooh. Nice.
So you kind of like, it looks like you've written boom.
Yep, it does look like that. Because that's what I said after I finished this film. I was like, boom!
What a That's movie. What you said when you saw that shot. You were just like, oh, boom, Fritz, yes!
Yes!
Yeah, I've got to say I agree with Ben in terms of the sound, because I feel like the whistling thing would have still worked fine if we had a bit of a score in some of the later scenes, because I remember the first time it did that when it was just complete silence. I was thinking, oh, is this like, because it's on YouTube and it's like a bit of a messed up edit of the original film.
Maybe they blocked the music for copyright.
Yeah, but I don't think that's the case. But that was just like, the fact that it like actively confused me to even check if I'd accidentally muted or something the first time means that I think it was a little bit jarring. But in terms of just like the cinematography and the story, although it's quite, I guess, straightforward by today's standards and compared to Metropolis, which I do still prefer Metropolis, but I feel like that's more just because I'd prefer something that was a massive pioneer in the sci-fi genre to the noir genre, just because I prefer sci-fi as a genre. But I still think this holds up really well. And I think after watching those two films, you can officially call me a Fritz Stan. So I'd go with an 8.2.
Cool. So, before we quickly go on to recommendations, we do have a submission spotlight section where you can, if you want to be featured on the podcast, you can send in your works of art, whether that's a short film, a music, or a art, or a written words, or something else. You can, you know, send it to our inbox, entertainmentofexcellence@gmail.com, or DM us on Instagram or TikTok, which is @EOVpodcast, and we post content on there regularly now, so you better go follow us. The website hasn't been updated since following, which was a good 10 episodes ago, so probably don't go there, but you could use the contact form there if you want. Yeah, cool. We've got some submissions that we will be catching up with at some point soon, although we won't give a definite answer yet. It might be next episode, it might not be, so you better tune in the future.
Recommendations,
it's
time for recommend.
Oh, sorry, am I supposed to do the jingle?
Dations.
Time for recommendations.
I think it needs to be demoted after that. It's awful.
Sorry. It's been a tough day. I've got a recommendation. I've got maybe...
Ooh, so do I.
I might go for two.
Ooh.
If I may. One quick one is that I've been... Just because we've talked about Metropolis, which, you know, I've not seen Mid-Tropolis, but...
apparently get off great. The podcast, you special guest.
I do want to watch it because I remember it. It's genuinely one of the first films that I remember my dad mentioning. So I've had it in my mind for years and never seen it. But on the sci-fi note, I have a subscription to 2000 AD. Yes, the weekly British sci-fi comic is still going, and there's some great stuff in there. And I'm loving the Judge Dredd storyline, which is in there, which I think is currently wrapping up, which is, it's just very depressing and dystopian, but I love it. And there's also the Thistlebone stuff is great. If you like some gothic horror, like painted style comics, there's some good stuff in there. But my main recommendation is that I watched the, I don't know if we've had this, but I'm going to recommend a stand-up special, guys. I watched Ricky Gervais' Armageddon. No, no, I'm joking. Jacqueline Novak's special called Get on Your Knees, which is an hour and a half stand-up special about giving blowjobs, and it's really good.
An hour and a
good.
Half? Bloody
it's an hour and a half, but it's really good. Like, I know what the subject, you know, it is.
Did it leave you satisfied and smiling, Tom?
Yeah, what?
Did it leave you satisfied and smiling?
It did. And I was, many giggles were had, but it's like almost poetic. She uses like amazing language and these like grand metaphors to be talking about, as I should say again, blowjobs. In fact, in the opening, she says that she's going to talk about blowjobs to the point of tedium, as one early review said.
any kids listening, she's a hairdresser.
Yes, and that was good. You should do an hour and a half stand-up special. But she's got great physical comedy, great jokes, just great use of language. I was like, it was one of those things where you watch it and you're like, wow, I should give up on all of my dreams because this person is so much better at everything. So you should watch that. It's on Netflix. Which is still the champion of streaming services. So, in terms of subscription numbers, so you've probably got access to Netflix. So, give it a watch, Jacqueline Novak. Get on your knees and watch the special.
Nice.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny. I should have said that. It's funny. It's really funny.
Okay. I'll take your word for it.
No, it's funny.
Okay.
I went. Like that.
That sounds pretty funny.
No.
That's another sound I made while I watched it. I did that as well. Anyway, what's... Would you want to recommend?
Well, I have a recommendation, and it
is a... Sorry, Ollie, come on.
It is a television series that was released in the... I can't remember when it was released. It was the 2010s. It's called Broadchurch, and it is kind of... It has some similarities to M, actually. Although I won't expand on what, because, you know, you should go watch it, and then you'll see for yourself. But it is... it's kind of... It's sort of a whodunit. Again, it's got some really strong characters, some fantastic performances. It's got David Tennant and Olivia Colman as the leads, who have fantastic chemistry together and are both just like really, really well written, really well acted. It has Jodie Whittaker as a grieving mother, who's again just fantastic. But the weirdest part of all of this is it's written by Chris Chibnall, who is widely known as the guy who rammed Doctor Who into the ground, which is really odd because this is a really well-done television show. It's like an 8.5 on IMDb. It's really fantastically well done, and it's got three seasons. I'd say the first season is probably the strongest in terms of plot, the second strongest in terms of characters, but that's not to say that the third season's bad or anything. It didn't fall off. Definitely watch all three seasons. It is available.
What was that
on...
called again? Wide Cathedral?
Yes, it is. it's available on all four, I think. That's on BritBox. or physical media. Does BritBox still exist? I mean, it says it's available on Just Watch, but I can't think of anyone who's got BritBox.
I think it's a big thing in America and also maybe Australia.
Maybe, yeah.
It's more for the people that go like, you should get BritBox. You know, those Brits are doing some really good TV.
Yeah, I want to see some quality British entertainment.
Exactly.
So yeah, go watch Broadchurch. It is very good. As David Tennant in his Scottish accent as well. There you go.
Ooh. Wow. Well, Ollie, do you have a recommendation?
I do.
Full
house today. A quick fire film that I think Tom's seen as well is Poor Things. I think it's still out in the cinema.
Yes! Yes!
It's good.
I love Poor Things.
It's a good film. But my second recommendation is some music. which we don't recommend very often on the podcast, but for those of you that don't know, I am a big fan of hip-hop music and specifically experimental rap. And I'm going to be recommending an experimental rap album by the group Clipping. Have you heard of this?
Heard of who?
Clipping.
Who, sorry?
What's the first two letters? I don't want to be...
Clipping.
Clipping?
Yeah.
Clipping?
No, no. It's just funny to hear you say clipping over and over. Sorry, what are they called again?
They're called Clipping.
Oh, yeah.
What does it sound like you're pronouncing your L with an R? It's like
what?
It's like you've got like a C-R-L ipping. Clipping. So I'm sorry, you go ahead, recommend.
This is top quality content.
Yeah. So I think they're a trio. And specifically recommending their, I think it's technically their second studio album because they had a mixtape first, but it's called Splendor and Misery. And the reason I'm recommending this is because it is a concept album and it's actually got quite a bit in common with 2001 A Space Odyssey, which is a podcast classic. So
the first movie to get a 10 out of 10 on this podcast.
Yeah.
From some people.
Boom! So
their music is pretty abrasive. Like they use sort of these really harsh industrial sounds and like alarms and stuff. So it's quite, maybe not the most pleasant of music to listen to all the time, but the lead MC is like a really, really skilled rapper. And I'd recommend all their projects, but this one specifically, it's the story of an astronaut who gets stranded in space and, everyone else on board dies and he's just left with this AI
hello
guy.
Sorry, that sounds like 2001 A Space Odyssey.
What's that?
I don't know.
And it's really interesting because it shows a bit of the relationship between him and the AI, but it's also got like these feelings of isolation. It's got him the way he sort of survives is through art and music, and like it's also got this interesting theme throughout of Afrofuturism and the way that it kind of parallels with a lot of slave experiences. So yeah, I don't want to give too much away, but if you're looking for an experimental rap concept album,
it's exciting to have
sci-fi
an
adjacent
album that someone doesn't want to give spoilers for. I've been missing them, you know. There's not been what's there been recently? Igor, I guess, that could be spoiled.
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes concept albums can feel a little bit gimmicky, especially if they like are really trying to stick to a narrative, but I think this handles it really effectively. It's not like as catchy as Ego, but it's very like experimental and interesting.
Would I like it if I like JPEG Mafia.
Yeah. I mean, I love JPEG Mafia and I like clipping as well. So
great. What about for fans of Death Grips?
Death Grips are good.
Okay, so, I will listen to it. What are they called again?
Clipping.
Well, I don't understand. Like you're pronouncing it like PCRLIPPING.
I'll be honest, I'm not even laughing at how you're pronouncing it. It's just the fact that every time it's kind of like, I don't know, it's just funny to get you to say clipping over and over again. Was it clipping? Wait, sorry, what were they called?
It's sort of a play on like when you get clipping on microphones because they use like, you know, these really weird sounds and whatever. But yeah, that's clipping anyone that's interested.
Well, the gain on your mic set right, otherwise you'll be clipping.
Yeah, that's what Ollie just explained was the...
But you know, it's a joke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And speaking of jokes, you know what's not a joke? Us going to come to your house and beat you up if you don't like and subscribe.
Yeah, like and subscribe and comment. If you got this far...
Which
then
you won't have,
because
the stats say no one watches past the first 20 seconds.
Well, exactly. So if you got this far, you don't comment M is for mid. Instead, you have to comment clipping.
All right, see ya.
So that's for the true fans. The true fans will put clipping. Okay.
That's how we'll know.
Yeah. Because we'll
looking
have forgotten
forward to
by
hearing
the time this
your
comes
comment,
out.
Will.
Yep. So, comment clipping down below. Follow us at EOV Podcast. In most places.
And to the catchphrase.
Yeah, the catchphrase. Oh, sorry, we have to say a catchphrase, don't we?
You do.
Is that the royal we?
Oh, is it just
you?
Me?
Just you.
I thought I set it up where we all say it together. Okay. Well, the catchphrase for this week is that we don't choose to make these podcasts. We have a natural impulse to do them.
I think that's your worst one. Yeah, right. All right, see ya.
Presented by Ollie Luff, Tom Sweeney, and Ben Stinson. Music by Tom Sweeney and Ben Stinson. Audio engineered by Ben Stinson at Longwater Productions. All Rights CR, created by Al Wright, Sr. All Rights, brackets, CR, close brackets, reserved.